Velkomin í samtal við samfélagið hlaðvarp félagsfræðinnar. Hjá mér í dag staddur David Reimer, prófessor í félagsfræði menntunar við Háskólan í Árósum. Í rannsóknum sínum hefur David skoðað ójöfnuð í menntun og þá sérstaklega hvort hann hefur áhrif á hverju fari í háskólanám. Rannsóknir Davids hafa birst í mörgum helstu tímaritum félagsfræðinnar og hefur hann hlutið styrki fyrir rannsóknir sínar meðal annars frá Velux-stofnuninni og North Face. En ég skipti nú yfir í ensku til að við fáum tækifæri til að læra meira rannsóknir Davids. Welcome, David, to our podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course, it is a pleasure. As I mentioned in my short introduction of you, is that you're currently a professor at the University of Aarhus. Could you maybe tell me a little bit about your academic journey and how you ended up in Denmark as a non-Danish human being?
Yes. I can do that, of course, you know. I'm one of the very many so-called love migrants, you know. Many academics at the University of Aarhus, where I'm at, you know, follow this path, I would say. And I basically was just, you know, when I was finishing my PhD, my wife, you know, Rosa, who's Icelandic, she got a position in history, and I just applied for a postdoc position at the University of Aarhus, at the School of Education. Was so lucky to get the position, yeah, and then, you know, by now I'm a professor, so...
So what was your track in terms of the school system? You got your PhD from University of Mannheim in Germany.
Yes, got my PhD at the University of Mannheim. And yeah, and what do you mean with the track? So I got then a postdoc at the University of Aarhus and was promoted to, you know, associate professor mm-hmm. eventually. And then, you know, my most recent promotion was to full professor or professor with special responsibilities, how it's actually called, in 2015.
Mm-hmm. And you also spent some time in the US.
Yes.
You met some fantastic people, I've heard.
Exactly. Just, you know, for the insiders, that's where, you know, Sigrun and I got to know each other in Indiana. Yes, Mannheim had an exchange program, and I was there in the year 1999-2000 and spent a year as a visiting graduate student. But I then, you know, returned to Mannheim, did my master's degree, and did my PhD then finally, you know, in 2009, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And your research is mostly within the field of sociology of education, of course, with, you know, maybe some connections to other sociological fields. But how did you become interested in research on education? What was it about education that attracted you?
It's a good question. I think it started out with having to choose a topic for my, you know, my MA degree, my MA thesis. And I was always interested in what do you do when you finish with your studies? You know, us as sociologists, sometimes we're faced with that question. I mean, what will you do? And there are also some stereotypes. And that, you know, that basically led to a survey study where we did a survey of all social science graduates at the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Mannheim, a large survey study, and then we studied sort of the transition from, you know, higher education to work. That's basically where my journey into mm-hmm. the sociology of education, you know, started. And also published my first academic article based on this, you know, on this study, basically, you know.
So what did you find?
Well, when we looked at gender differences, again, gender differences, you know, among social science graduates, and we found, surprisingly, that even, you know, I mean, these are all graduates who have the same type of degree, there was still a small, you know, wage gap between female and male academics. And what we also found that if you look for, okay, maybe, you know, can this be explained that by, you know, the male graduates somehow having better skills or something, But what we found was the opposite, and that the female graduates actually had higher, you know, better skills, you know. Mm-hmm. So they were more motivated and so forth. So.
And what do you mean by skills here?
Skills, I mean, maybe skills is also a misleading term, just in terms of like their grades, you know, like their, I mean, the grades and also their level of motivation and everything. And that could not explain that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just a small gap, but that could not explain the difference at all, you know. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, either it's maybe discrimination or it's maybe this, you know, there's this... famous paper that's like nice women don't, I don't know, don't like to ask, like this phenomenon that women might be less inclined to ask for a raise, for mm-hmm. example, something like that, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I've heard it both in a way that they may be less likely to start with to ask for a raise, but I also seem to recall that they're also, like, if they're turned down,
exactly,
they're less likely to continue to ask. That may also be part of the difference, is that men will just ask until they get the raise.
And that's also still, there's a very recent article about exactly this phenomenon mm-hmm. in the American Sociological Review.
That was probably what I was reading.
That finds something similar, and that also finds that, you know, I mean, that females, women with, you know, very good grades sometimes have harder times finding a job or are mm-hmm. penalized for that, you know, because, you don't want, you know, women that are too smart. I mean, mm-hmm. just to basically paraphrase the argument, you know.
Well, I think it's already also interesting, you know, thinking about the school system in general and what is happening there. And there was some study I saw from the US, for instance, that was looking at how students evaluated each other. And basically what it found was that everyone was evaluating the male students as smarter,
yeah.
regardless of the grade. So to a certain extent, maybe a boy who was having, I don't know, like a B plus as an average,
yeah.
was perceived by fellow students, male and females, as being smarter than a female who was maybe making all A's.
There's also, you know, along those lines, not quite my topic, but I always refer to this one study, the study that an experiment in online teaching,
mm-hmm.
The experiment allowed them to, you know, to shift the instructor gender, yeah. you know. And then they could find that, you know, if the instructor gender was always the same instructor, but if the students thought the instructor was a female, then they actually gave that instructor, you know, the reviews were worse, you know, for the female, which is also quite telling, you know. So.
Yeah, I remember I saw that study and saw more general or like others that have kind of shown similar patterns, and not that I'm, you know, losing sleep over my teaching evaluations, but I remember seeing this title, "What Should You Do to Improve Your Student Evaluations?" And I got kind of excited, like, you know, here is like, or I think it was the one thing you can do, and I was like, oh, this is going to be easy, like, yeah. you know, one thing I can do. And then, of course, the answer was be a man.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you know. But it is really remarkable how we see those gender differences virtually in every aspect of, I mean, I think another thing that's interesting to see here is also what kind of materials kids are getting in school from the age of six.
Yeah.
And, you know, both in terms of how we view history, who is doing anything important, but even I was reading in some cases like who is used as an example in
yeah.
math examples and how that's disproportionately males.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Maybe if I can, you know, can go back to this this example of teaching evaluations, you know, if some of the interested listeners want to do that, I can recommend an online tool which is called Rate My Professor, and there's mm-hmm. a young professor in the digital humanities, Ben Schmidt, and he did this tool where you can visualize how, you know, what words are used in, you know, online evaluation in the mm-hmm. United States. So you can type in a word like, for example, you know, genius, and you can see, okay, how many students use this particular word to describe teaching in, you know, in different fields,
mm-hmm.
you know? And you will find that across most disciplines, genius is applied more to males than mm-hmm. you know, from females. And then if you use a term such, for example, bitchy, you'll mm-hmm. find these are actually two things I tried out. You
yeah.
find that overall there are more women, you know, being described as, you know, bitchy as opposed mm-hmm. to men. You know, quite interesting. Again, Ben Schmidt, Rate My Professor.
That's very interesting, and I mean, I think it, and I've seen some of those things, and it's really interesting to a certain extent see the things that you see in your own evaluations and how students perceive you. I think one of the things that, you know, I always felt students really got mad if they didn't see you in that way as a female was, I think the word I got most frequently was kind, like they really want you to be kind.
Yeah.
But I think exactly like, you know, one of those things, like you don't get brilliant, you don't get genius, but you get things like very knowledgeable, knows the material really well, organized.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think very intelligent is probably like, you know, the sort of highest remark I've
yeah.
seen.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, you look at these and you sort of like, you know, think about this and you know about like, you know, some of your male colleagues are getting those words. And you know, I probably shouldn't say that on the podcast, but, and this was not at the University of Iceland, but, you know, who may not have been putting very much into their teaching, but yet were brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think that's also one of the things that you see is with women, if students don't understand what you're saying, it's because that is something wrong with you.
Yeah.
But if it's a male professor, they just don't understand what they are talking about because they are so brilliant.
Exactly.
But then you see sort of these large series, including what you're talking about, that are looking at this. And then you basically see your individual experiences play out at the aggregative when we are looking at male and female academics.
Yeah, yeah. And that's also why I'm very highly skeptical in terms of using those evaluations for, what can I say, you know, high stakes decisions. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think, for example, a salary increases should be based on these student evaluations. Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, in the US, I mean, and differently at different universities, but it's certainly a piece of getting tenure, which in the US case basically means the promotion to an associate professor. And if you get tenure, you have a job for the rest of your life. If you don't get it, you're out of a job. So the stakes are quite high.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a part of the things that goes into the evaluations. And then if you know that systematically students are evaluating women lower than men, that is obviously a major problem.
Yeah, it is. Definitely.
And maybe going a little bit now, as we have had this general discussion on what I think is fascinating, but going back to your research that is equally or even more fascinating, and starting with the talk that you are giving here at the University of Iceland, and it's on the impact of classroom disciplinary climate on student learning. Is it too much to ask to give us a brief version of the talk? What are the highlights? What do we need to know here in Iceland?
I'll try my best. Well, it is about, as you said, I mean, the classroom disciplinary climate. And I should first start out by saying, I mean, what is this? And the way we measure it, I mean, it's actually not we, it's, you know, it's a PISA, it's the way it's done in the PISA study. Students are asked to evaluate, you know, in this case, mathematics teaching, and then they're asked, okay, is there noise and disorder in the classroom? And how long does it take until, you know, the classroom quiets down? And, you know, are there disturbance? Like, there are five questions like this. And we basically, we just, you know, take the average of these five questions, and that's quite okay. And then we can use this to calculate, okay, what's the disciplinary climate in a specific school? You know, this is average measurement, and it actually functions quite well. And we do see, in this particular paper, we just look at the Nordic countries.
Iceland included, yes.
Yes.
We like that.
For reasons I can elaborate on later on if you're interested.
Is it the most interesting case?
Absolutely. And we find that there's a significant association with, you know, student learning as measured in the PISA test, in terms of math achievement. And we also find that that's sort of the new thing about this paper. That's not new. I mean, there are others who've done
this. So basically, I would assume the more distractions,
exactly,
the worse the student learning.
Exactly, yeah. The more distraction, and that's this doesn't seem to be sort of a random finding. It's quite well established, you know. And there are some variation across cultural contexts, but we do find it in all the Nordic countries. But the new thing about this particular paper is that we look at gender differences. You know, do boys and girls, do they first perceive the classroom climate differently? That's the first thing. And then, you know, does this lead to sort of a different gender differentiated effect? Do boys or girls suffer more from a negative climate? And our hypothesis is that boys might be more susceptible to a negative classroom climate. And that might be the case. I mean, we should have leaned on some theoretical thoughts here, because, I mean, if you look at the literature on, you know, gender differences, now boys are the ones that are more, you know, more problematic in many kind of ways. If you look at, you know, like ADHD diagnosis, and then boys are much more likely to be diagnosed, and also boys are more likely to maybe disturb in the classroom and so forth. And our hypothesis was, okay, maybe, you know, boys might be more susceptible, as I said, to the negative classroom climate. And when we find that, actually, you know, across all Nordic countries, this is a relatively stable finding. It's not a huge difference, but it's big enough that one should maybe, you know, look at this, you know, that there might be those gender differences, you know. What we also did is we looked at, okay, do girls and boys perceive the climate differently? Just sort of in terms of these, I mean, and that's also the case, but maybe not in the direction that we thought. It is actually boys, and these, you know, in this particular study, PISA, the PISA study from the year 2012, actually the boys in the Nordic countries that see the climate a little more positively. You know, that surprised us, actually. But a negative classroom climate has a more negative effect, you know, for boys than for for girls, if you can use the word effect. But again, that's a different discussion.
Well, but I think it's interesting, sort of, in broader debates, and you brought in ADHD. And, you know, often one of the things that is talked about is, you know, different ways of understanding what ADHD is. And one of it, you know, simply being that it's a biological disease and we need to do something about it. And then, of course, boys would be more likely to have ADHD. We see it as an individual problem. We see that we need to do something about that kid, often a boy, which often would be medication. But then have also have others suggested that, you know, when we think about how we socialize the genders, in terms of, like, you know, from a very young age, you know, boys are kind of like encouraged to be loud, to run around, to be in like pretty active games. And girls are more encouraged to maybe play house or be closer to the where, you know, the staff would be at the kindergarten. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, you're 6 years old and you go to a school and you're all to a certain extent expected to behave like a girl. Or like, you know, as a girl, not like as, you know, what we sort of gendered expectations of females would be. So some have actually, like, you know, here argued that, you know, of course, like, our educational system is socially constructed. There is nothing that says we have to have, like, you know, kids sit still for a certain amount of time. There is nothing that wouldn't say that, like, you know, they could, you know, for that matter, like, you know, stand up and run around every 20 minutes. And maybe that would get out some of the, we also know that boys, you know, do have maybe more need to release energy than girls do. So what do you sort of think about those debates, that we should really maybe be looking at the educational system rather than the individual?
I'm completely on board, you know, with this, I mean, with these thoughts. Of course, I mean, in Denmark, actually, it's quite interesting. There's a debate regarding upbringing, you know, upbringing and socialization. And basically, I mean, the thing about this, it's quite a controversial debate, but I mean, if I should summarize it, it's okay, I mean, politicians saying, okay, parents, you know, you need to, I mean, it's also your responsibility. It's not only the schools, you know, parents need to, I mean, and it's kind of, it's quite normative, this this debate, you know. But if I get back to this aspect of gender, you know, I think what's sort of, you know, by no means like a gender theorist or know so much about gender studies, but I think one of the problems is basically this, I mean, this ideal of masculinity, you know, what is it to be cool for a boy, you know? I think for girls, and that's sort of much easier to sort of find their way in school. I mean, for a typical girl, just being good in school doesn't interfere with, like, being sort of, I don't know, like an attractive girl or a cool girl, not as much in any case. That might be the case for boys, you know. That, I mean, that's maybe not cool to be sort of really good in mathematics or, in Icelandic or Danish, or for that matter, you know. And I think that's sort of, you know, that's very difficult questions to, I mean, what to do with that, you know. But that's also, I mean, part of our research maybe points in that direction, you know, and that this is a problem. But I also wouldn't have no ready-made solution how to sort of tackle these issues. It's like a general, more societal trend, you know, that does not only apply to, you know, boys, but men in general, I would say.
Well, I would also think about, I think it's interesting you bring this up, but I would also think about if this is something that might change as boys and girls grow older. Because one can also think about, you know, maybe when you are, you know, 16, 18, 20, at that point in time, for instance, it may be inconsistent with, you know, the gender roles to be smarter than all the boys. And of course, that depends on context. Like, it may be weaker in the Nordic countries than maybe in some countries where gender roles are more rigid.
Maybe, you know, there's a study also by two American sociologists who look at, you know, it's also something that interests me, is look at sort of what fields do male and female students choose. And there's always so much interest in sort of science fields, you know, this so-called STEM field, you know, science, technology fields. And the concern is always, okay, there are not enough, you know, women choosing these science field, you know, this field. And that might be a problem for many kind of reasons, but there's also quite a lot of literature on this. And this particular study, they look at, okay, how rigorous is sort of the science teaching in different schools, you know. And they find that those schools that are very, very rigorous, and they, you know, they have kind of a creative way of measuring this, in these schools, girls or young women are more likely to choose science fields. Mm-hmm. So in other words, there's also something there's something that can be done, you know, mm-hmm. in the way. I mean, how much? I mean, there was all the how much hours were, you know, of science teaching was there at those schools, and how much emphasis was mm-hmm. there. So that I thought was also quite mm-hmm. interesting, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I think even in some of those debates, it's interesting to see to a certain extent how what we value in society is more likely to be associated with males than females. Because we see a lot of those debates, and I mean, I think we see across societies, like, you know, we need more women in medicine, we need more women in engineering, but we don't really have quite the same emphasis on that we need more men in education, we need more men in nursing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true and very interesting. Even though there's one related debate that's quite interesting regarding teacher gender, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of those, I mean, and it also potentially refers to this boy crisis. That there's this hypothesis that, you know, boys might benefit from a same-sex teacher, either from a, you know, male teacher, and possibly the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I mean, the findings are very debated, one would say. And that means, okay, we need more, you know, male teachers, you know, mm-hmm. in Grundschule, you know, in compulsory schooling. I mean, I'm not sure where I stand myself, you know. But it's interesting to think about this, you know. I'm highly doubtful. I think mm-hmm. you know. I mean, it's more important that, you know, a good teacher will be a good teacher for mm-hmm. boys and for girls. That's my personal opinion on that, mm-hmm. on that matter, you know.
Well, I mean, I would think though, to a certain extent, I mean, we can think about it in terms of, you know, identification and role models as well, and maybe it matters differently at different stages. And I mean, I think one of the things that we are seeing at the universities. I mean, I think it's very important that we are seeing more and more female professors. Even though I was pursuing my PhD at the top sociology program in the US and going from Iceland, I never saw myself as ending up as an academic or as a professor. And, you know, sort of for a long period, I was like, oh, it was just like, you know, my own insecurities and, you know, attributing it to individual factors. And then like thinking back on my experience, it's like I didn't have a role model.
Yeah.
All the professors who were teaching me were sort of authoritative men, at least over 50.
Yeah.
And there were some women who were teaching, but none of them, for instance, had a position. Like they may be teaching one class or being adjuncts or something like that. So everyone you saw as a professor fit the model of being a male.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's... that, you know, those role models, you know, I mean, they play a role, I mean, at different stages of your educational mm-hmm. career, you know. It might also be, you know, if you first go to, you know, gymnasium or mentor school, okay, mm-hmm. do you know somebody who did that, you know?
Yeah.
Who is that person? Can you relate to that person?
Mm-hmm.
And you think, okay, that person did it, you know, I can possibly do it too, you know?
Yeah.
If you lack these people, then that might be more difficult. Or this making this, I mean, decision mm-hmm. might be much more of a challenge, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also, you know, if you talk about educational inequalities, that's one of these, you know, discussions. It's okay if that's everybody in your family, you know, went on to university, and you see, you know, you have all those relatives, including mm-hmm. your parents, who went to university, then, you know, you might not question yourself so much
mm-hmm.
as opposed to when you're just the only one or the first one, you know, like the first generation mm-hmm. student, you know, the way one talks about this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was actually like just thinking about transitioning into talking about your work on inequalities in education. And that seems like, even though you have, you know, various other projects, but that's kind of like the big thing that would characterize your research.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I know some of it, so we kind of like, you know, start to talk about it. I know several of the papers you've done related to that are doing cross-national comparisons. What have you found in sort of this body of research?
Yeah, so again, I've done, you know, various papers in sort of in relation to educational inequalities, but it's true when you say that sort of this access to higher education or this transition from, you know, upper secondary education to higher education is sort of I've done most work and it interests me the most. And in terms of, I mean, what we always find, we find in all countries, including Iceland, that, you know, I mean, those who have the more privileged kids, they're more likely to go to university, even if, you know, I mean, even if they're bad grades, or if you take two sort of more or less mm-hmm. identical students, and one student has a father, you know, who is a university professor, identical students also in terms of their grades, and the other has a father who's just, or parents who maybe who just have, you know, I mean, working as handyman, which is by no means bad, but the one with the, you know, university educated parent is much more likely to choose university, you know, and that's just, that we know that, you know. But if you think about cross-national differences, then it's very interesting to think about the way the higher education system, for example, is structured, you know, and how you basically achieve your upper secondary, you know, qualification. I mean, if you think about the United States, everybody goes to high school, and I mean, unless you drop out, everybody finishes with a high school degree, which in principle allows you to go on to, you know, to study at university. In Germany, and same in Iceland, I mean, you first have to go to gymnasium, like to Mentorskole here. So there's a prior transition, which already sorts out, you know, quite a few students. You know, it's not quite clear if this increases or reduces inequality, but that's in any case quite important to think about. You know, in Switzerland, for example, that's the example that comes to mind where it's most extreme. There's already only relatively little proportion of students, I think just about a third, 20% that actually get this, you know, upper secondary qualification that even allows them to go on, you know. And in Switzerland, that inequality in access to higher education is also quite high, you know. That's one of the first thing one needs to think about, the way, I mean, how is sort of the achievement of the qualification that allows you to go on to university, how is that sort of organized, you know, and who's allowed to go on or not. And the next question that's interesting to think about in a cross-national perspective is, of course, again, how is the higher education system structured, you know? Is there maybe like a binary sector? Do you have like high prestige universities and then maybe not quite as prestigious university colleges? That's, by the way, it is in Denmark, you know. So in Denmark, if you want to become a pedagogue, you know, an elementary school teacher, then you go on to university colleges. And these are good jobs, but we see clearly that these are, you know, I mean, these university colleges are more often chosen by, you know, I mean, less privileged students. You know? So there's so like this binary divide, which also, you know, leads to a social gradient. You know? In France, for example, you have a relatively large university sector, but you have those, you know, grandes écoles, like the small elite sector, you know. And that's very interesting. And then I think it's just 5 to max 10%, I think, that of the student body that goes on there. But this is highly selective. You have to, you know, pass entrance exams to even get in. Students, you know, prepare for these entrance exams in, I think, for a year, maybe for 2 years. You know? I mean, there are special courses offered just that you can pass those entrance exams. And all the major politicians we know in France, you know, Macron would be the most recent example. They have a degree from a grande école. So that's the way to go, you know. So here you create an elite sector, the most like the position people in power in both, you know, I mean, in economy and in the political system in France, they went there, you know. So that of course also, you know, says something about inequality. In Germany, it's not interestingly, we have the divide between universities and like universities of applied sciences. But that's not quite as consequential in terms of, you know, I mean, if you look at maybe later positions and in incomes, you know, that's also one of research interests of mine. That's where maybe other forms of differentiation might play a role. What might be another form of differentiation? Maybe what kind of field, you know, you study that might be more consequential. If everybody's at the same level, then this might play a role. You know, I mean. Sociologist, I mean, Sam Lucas, he framed this term effectively maintained inequality. What he basically means by that is, okay, maybe if, you know, if everybody gets to a certain level, then those qualitative forms of differentiation might be more consequential. You know? And we see that. We see that in France, you know. We see that also in sort of, terms of field of study choice at the level of university, that there's a gradient. I mean, if you look at the social composition of, for example, law students as opposed to, you know, students in sociology, you would most typically see that the law students on average have more parents, you know, that have also a university degree. You know,
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, the things you've been talking about, and, you know, to a certain extent getting to a lot of what is at the heart of sociology, and really to a certain extent shows us that even when we are thinking about those major institutions in societies, we can still see social construction. So, I mean, you see all of those variations. And of course, I mean, we see all societies, you know, basically having some kind of basic education, and then you move on in some ways, and then you move on to certain kind of institutions and higher level institutions. But basically how those are organized and thought about varies drastically, even across countries that, like, you know, we would see as, you know, potentially fairly similar. And then maybe one of the things that we often do not see, and, you know, your work and sociology has the power to show, is that those have consequences.
Yeah.
So you can sort of think about, well, you know, we all, like, you know, at some point may get some kind of a degree, but the way that the field itself is organized within a country can have huge consequences for how inequalities are created and sustained within a particular context.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, what sociologists are so interested in is, I mean, the rules of admission, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, who gets in and how is it structured, you know, I mean, what are the procedures, you know, what are the exceptions, you know, I mean, sometimes there are rules how to get in, and then again, possibly more privileged parents, you know,
mm-hmm.
and their offspring might find ways to get around this anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And one example that I think also happened, I mean, in Iceland, if I recall correctly, is like getting into the medical field, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, studying to become a medical doctor, where like some students, I think, like went to court to get a, you know, I mean, to get in.
Mm-hmm.
That also happened in Germany sometimes, you know. And then, of course, who are these students normally, you know?
Yeah.
These are typically not the students, I mean, who have two working class parents.
Exactly.
So that's, it's also quite interesting, yeah.
And the German system, historically, and I don't know if it's changing or losing it up in some ways, I mean, because Germany does quite intensive tracking. So
yes.
Kids are tracked pretty early on.
Yeah. So that's exactly, in educational sociology, we use the term tracking, as you say. And tracking means just, I mean, you sort students into different tracks, you know. And again, all school systems do that eventually. And again, in Iceland, that's, you know, the transition to Mentorschule. In Germany, we have the same transition to Gymnasium, but it's, you know, students, it's typically in most, you know, because Germany is a federal system, and so in most federal states, it's already after grade four.
That would be about 10?
It's 11, yeah.
11 years old.
I mean, average age is 11. And it's quite consequential because, again, only the upper secondary track, the gymnasium track, allows you then to go on to higher education.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty early, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there are studies who show that this early tracking, the earlier you track, the more inequality in
mm-hmm.
terms of, like, the, you know, I mean, this, I mean, the transition rate, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you can show that also cross-nationally.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there are also some, you know, I mean, explanations for that, because, I mean, of course, at this age, who sort of comes to make the decision, you know,
mm-hmm.
at age 11, it's, of course, it's based on typically like how the student performs in school, but, I mean, the parents play such a major role,
mm-hmm.
you know. And parents will always play an important role in these decisions,
mm-hmm.
but, I mean, students, especially those, you know, who are maybe, you know, let's say the smart, but not super smart, working class students,
mm-hmm.
they might then be in a better position when they're a little older, when they're 14, mm-hmm. 15, 16 years old to make this decision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to go on to, you know, I mean, to upper secondary education and then possibly to, you know, university. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's also, I mean, interesting both in this way of, you know, even just being, you know, willing to say that at age 10, we can predict for, you know, what your educational trajectory is going to be. But also this interaction, I think, between the schools and the family. And actually, the first time I learned about this was from a friend who was then in graduate school in Germany and has his PhD today. And he was actually supposed to be tracked to a different kind of system.
Yeah.
But his parents, being like well-educated professionals, were like, no, my kid is not gonna,
exactly.
My kid is going to gymnasium. So those parents have, like, you know, to a certain extent, both the capabilities and, I don't know what you would call it, determination to say, like, you know, this is not acceptable, but they also have the skill to go to the school, to negotiate with the, you know, school and saying basically, like, you know, getting teens in tracks for that particular kid.
Yeah, it's you know, what's really interesting in this respect is the way, you know, this transition is basically organized. You know, we talk about a so-called binding recommendation
mm-hmm.
by the school or non-binding recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
Binding meaning, okay, it's, you know, the teachers, they decide, you know, what school you go to. Non-binding is, okay, we give you a recommendation, you know, based on your academic
mm-hmm.
record, we think, you know, student A should maybe go to, you know, I mean, to upper secondary education or not. And then sociologists, of course, interested, okay, what are the consequences for inequality?
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe, I mean, there are a few papers on this, and the finding is somewhat, maybe counterintuitive in that sense that a binding recommendation, you know, leads to less inequality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, exactly because of those mechanisms that you were talking about, because that sort of leaves those parents that maybe, you know, would want to promote their, maybe their, you know, lesser academically skilled offspring to negotiate, you know,
mm-hmm.
if it's binding. But again, mm-hmm. even in those cases, sometimes, you know, if parents really want, then they can find a way around it,
mm-hmm.
you know, or they will do something that the student will end up, you know, going to the, you know, to the upper secondary mm-hmm. school track anyways, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, and that's often, and of course, like, we have, you know, societies in ways that sustain inequalities, and often societies have been set up in a way and are continue to be set up in a way where certain inequality is accepted and even just taken for granted. But there is also, I think, something particularly, I think what you would say today is sort of the more that you allow the individual to negotiate these kind of different things, the more potential there is for being able to use advantage that comes with upper class position into more positive outcomes.
Yeah, that's true. That's also a hypothesis that has, although that's not, I mean, there are sort of mixed evidence, but there's also a hypothesis if you think about different subjects in school.
Mm-hmm.
You think, okay, like a subject like math, you would possibly expect that the grading of a math paper is more, I mean, there's less room to sort of for teachers mm-hmm. to sort of, okay, transfer, I mean, look at specific language code, specific mm-hmm. sort of ways of expressing, you know, students expressing themselves. So to expect that, you know, if you look at math as opposed mm-hmm. to like languages, that there's a less of a social gradient. And again, there's mixed evidence
yeah.
for that, you know, but I mean, there's something that certainly, there's a study on, you know, with Norwegian data,
mm-hmm.
Norwegian census data at the university that points in that direction, you know, that's actually true. Yeah.
And maybe moving, like we've been talking about cross-national very broadly, but you've also focused on inequalities within the Nordic countries. And, you know, sort of first question is even just, you know, the fact that the Nordic countries are, you know, generally both perceived and observed as the most equal countries in the world. Do we still find inequalities in education within the Nordic context?
Yeah, we do. And that's kind of almost a puzzle. You think about, especially now, think about Denmark. Denmark, okay, you know, schools are free. That's the case in most, you know, industrialized countries. But there's, if you think about going to university, I mean, you don't have to pay to go to university. And on the top of that, every student who wants to do that gets a stipend, you know. And it's not a super generous stipend, but it's close to enough to cover your living expenses and everything. You know? In other words, sort of this cost factor is almost eliminated. And yet we see, you know, pronounced inequalities in access to, you know, university education. Maybe not quite as high as in Germany or the US, but on the other hand, also not that, you know, that far off.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, okay, why is that the case?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, of course, I mean, again, it's a long discussion. But what some of my colleagues have pointed to is that, like, these cultural transmission processes, you know, that we know about it, like in upper class families, you know, I mean, politics and literature and everything is discussed, you know. So these things, of course, they happen independent of, you know, economic resources, you know, I mean, the sort of the transmission of cultural capital, you know. And that's of course just as important in the Nordic countries mm-hmm. as in all other countries mm-hmm. in this world, you know. And that's something you also can't eliminate with mm-hmm. generous stipends,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's also like a more general, I mean, question: is it even possible to do something
mm-hmm.
about that? Because these inequalities will, in a sense, always, you know,
mm-hmm.
will always sort of take place, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think that's always, and it's really interesting to think about. And, you know, sociologists have defined class in a wide array of ways. I mean, some very strictly focused on the economic base of class differences, but then you have others who, you know, talk about class more as people who share a lifestyle, and obviously from Bourdieu on, like, cultural capital. And I think that's, like, also one of the things that becomes more and more important in, you know, societies that are trying to equalize out those differences based on income, because that's the focus, and maybe it's hard to have a different focus. And I was reading, you know, for instance, somewhere just in terms of teachers and like, you know, what happens in school, both what is valued within schools, which often is more closely related to the kind of skills and ideas, exposure that kids from the upper class get. And you can sort of think about here, you know, you're taking a class on literature in, you know, middle school or secondary school, and, you know, you're exposed to some literature, and you have like, you know, maybe a kid who, oh, this is like, you know, where we went on vacation, and we actually went and looked at the house of Jane Austen or whoever that might be. You immediately sort of are sending a signal to the teacher, oh, that kid is pretty smart.
Yeah, absolutely. And there, I mean, again, I mean, I'm somewhat, you know, my take is one should also be nuanced in these, you know, because I think teachers are very capable, and I think teachers are also, I mean, because this is sometimes like this narrative, like the teachers are discriminating against, you know, less privileged kids, and I don't quite believe that. But on the other hand, I mean, there are all those subtle mechanisms are going on. I mean, in every interaction, you know, I mean, yeah, there are those cultural signifiers that will play a role, you know.
And I think that's the point that makes this so hard, is that I don't think we would think about this as exactly as you're saying. It's not discrimination. It's not that, like, you know, the system itself or a teacher is thinking about, oh, I value this one less than this one. But sort of incorporated in even how we think about the schools, how we think about the curriculum, is more likely to reflect the value of the middle and the upper class.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And in some ways, like, you know, kids from those classes may just fit better in. Without anyone really doing anything to discriminate against anyone else.
Yeah, that's, you know, and that's, I mean, some of you might know this, and that's also not my level of expertise, but, you know, if any of you has watched The Wire.
The Wire, you know, from HBO. Most important sociological. They did have a course on that at some universities in the US.
But one example that I also showed to my students in class is where basically, you know, the young black girl has a problem figuring out a math problem, and then the brother explains the math problem, you know, to her sort of in the language of the street, you know. And then, you know, like she gets it right away, you know. And that's basically The Wire sort of giving us a good example of how culturally biased a test can be. You know? Or if you put it basically, you know, if you frame the question basically with the reference points that, you know, the respective student can relate to, then it's easier you know, for the student to solve this problem. You know?
Well, and that was a huge debate in the US in particular, for instance, with the IQ tests.
Exactly.
That, for instance, were for a long time used to basically make the statement that white people were smarter than black people.
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, sort of that even being taken for granted and not looking at, well, are there any biases in the test itself? And what really is the test measuring? Like, is it measuring underlying intelligence, or is it measuring certain kind of intelligence that is valued in a society where white people have historically had more power?
Yeah, the people who design those tests, you know, and that also, you know, refers to this, you know, like a test like PISA that we talked about earlier, the study that we used for our disciplinary climate paper. They have this problem if they want to construct a test that is culturally compatible. That's, of course, sort of the main assumption of the PISA study, is that those test items, you know, function or are just as difficult in Iceland as they are in China, you know. And there are also quite a few papers that show that that is not the case, you know. And if you think about that, it's so hard to do, you know. It's so hard to do to come up with items that are just as difficult, you know, in every language. I mean, at least in the native language, it's difficult. I think in mathematics, it works a little better, you know.
I think it can work. Yeah, and I mean, I agree with that. And I mean, I think often those cultural assumptions, and I don't know if, you know, Icelandic schools would really test on this, but I think one of the instances where I saw this really well was the first night we went out in Bloomington, like, so you were probably there when we went to Yogi's, and I was sitting with all these Americans and, you know, some Germans, and somehow this came up, and I don't know, you know, in what context I felt, you know, compelled to say this sentence, but basically saying, like, well, as we all know, when the sun comes up, the trolls turn into a stone. And I could just, like, you know, see, like, these looks at me. Like, oh my God, like, who is this woman? And why is he talking about trolls? And why? And then you just kind of see this. Like, I mean, for me, that, like, I mean, even, you know, if you may not have completely believed in trolls, but this is just something that, like, you know, we just all know this.
Yeah.
And that's often like, you know, what you're sort of saying is that, like, you know, knowledge is embedded both within particular national context, but we also historically in, I think we can generalize to all societies, we've always had groups that are valued more than other groups, and we always have groups where their knowledge is valued more than the knowledge of other groups.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But maybe getting back to, you know, you asked me about, you know, I mean, if there's anything sort of related to Iceland. That
yes, I was exactly gonna, you read my mind. Yes. This is where I was going.
And I have actually, I have one particular paper right now where we measure the level of inequality in educational attainment based on those PISA scores in all Nordic countries. And we try to see, okay, does it actually make a difference, you know, the way you measure, you know, the parental background? Do you look at parental education? Do you look at parental occupation? Do you look at, you know, parental cultural capital and so forth? And do we, if we sort of switch those parental background measures, does that sort of affect our conclusions about the, you know, intensity of education inequality in the different Nordic countries? And what we find is that actually those different measurements are quite stable, even if we exchange, like, you know, I mean, education and occupation. I mean, there are some important differences, but overall, the level is quite, I mean, it's fairly similar. And we found actually, for example, that was based on PISA 2015, that Sweden had, in PISA 2015, Sweden had the highest level of educational inequality, and Iceland had consistently the lowest level. Meaning Iceland, out of the Nordic countries, again, measured, you know, and this is science performance in PISA, with PISA 2015, Iceland was consistently, you know, the country that sort of had the lowest level of inequality. You know. But this is, of course, not to confuse with the sort of the average attainment. You know, there Iceland is quite average in the Nordics. You know, I mean, or maybe even slightly below average.
No, but not per capita.
No, of course.
Per capita, we are doing the best.
Yeah, of course. That's, by the way, also an interesting discussion that the economists have. Is there a trade-off between sort of, you know, efficiency and inequality? Basically, like this hypothesis that, okay, you can, if you have more, maybe you can create a more, you know, equal system, but that's the cost of sort of basically having top performers, you know. But I mean, so far, that nothing points in that direction. I mean, actually, the research points in the direction that if you want sort of higher average performances, you also have to do something for the low performance. That's what you know. In other words, sort of doing something for those who perform badly, it benefits everybody and also will lead to higher country averages. Even though one should also be, you know, as I just said, I mean, one should also really watch out to compare countries, you know, especially if they're just few point differences. I don't think that means anything. Although I do think that, you know, this measurement of inequality captures, I mean, some, I mean, is valid in a sense, you know.
But I think it's also interesting, and I mean, sort of thinking, and we've talked quite a bit about the standardized testing, we've talked about, you know, PISA and some of those other studies, looking at math scores and various other things. And I was just seeing, I think it's a World Economic Forum that is talking about the job skills needed for the 21st century. And, you know, one of the top ones there, for instance, is critical thinking. You know, it has things like, you know, skills in interaction, it has creativity. Are those being measured at all in those kind of standardized tests that we, you know, get so upset about if we are not, like, you know, towards the top of?
Yeah, interestingly, yes. And there's also, and that's very interesting, if you look at the OECD, you know, that's behind PISA, they're more and more sort of aware of that they can't just sort of, you know, measure how good students are at, you know, solving math equations. So they're more and more focused on sort of, you know, problem solving and cooperation skills, and which is, you know, in a way sort of is a response to much of the critique of PISA. But the reason why they do it is much more, it's sort of, I mean, comes from like all those, you know, human capital, you know, arguments, or basically they know by now, economists also know by now, that in order to predict sort of future labor market success, it's by no means enough to just know how good somebody is in math. So there's a whole different skill set, which maybe, you know, interpersonal skills, problem solving, all of this, which is of course maybe related to logical thinking, but that there might be also a whole different skill set that is relevant, you know. And as we all know, you know, if you look at your high school class, the people, you know, turn out to be successful are not necessarily not the ones that are the best in school, mm-hmm. you know, but maybe the ones who, you know, I mean, there's of course correlation. And then again, that's the reason why the OECD started to, they try to measure as much as they can now. Yeah.
Well, I think that's precisely like, you know, going back to Germany and like, you know, wanting to predict this a 10-year-old is problematic. But I mean, I also remember even at a higher level, and I still, this was probably when I was in like, you know, fourth or fifth year of graduate school. And I remember I was talking to Brian Powell, who was the director of graduate studies when, you know, we were there. And, you know, to go into grad school in the US, I mean, of course, they have your grades, they have your placement, like, in the rankings, and they have the standardized test, which is called the GRE. And he basically just said, like, we are horrific in sort of predicting success in grad school. And, you know, kind of like this assumption, everyone who gets in is pretty smart.
Yeah.
But those who come out as being sort of identified as stars based on the tests tend to maybe drop out or not being like as successful, if we can talk about that, as maybe some of those who looked kind of like a little bit of losers according to their GRE.
Yeah, but again, I mean, there is, of course, there is a correlation if you look at, you know, what kind of grades students get in fifth grade, you know, and how they perform in the air market. There is a correlation,
of course there is,
but it's far from perfect, you know. So, and there's so many other things that matter, you know.
And it's within specific groups. I mean, I think that, like, you know, if you put someone with extremely low GRE, you would see those differences. But I think often we are talking maybe about so small differences that it fails to capture like the complexities of the kind of skill sets that an individual may bring to the table.
Yeah. And it's also, if you sort of look at this, you know, again, if you think about the Nordic countries, you know, and the way they perform, and I mean, where, you know, what are the Nordic countries known for? You know, I mean, Iceland, for example, it's music, you know, among other things. Denmark has, you know, great television, great movies. I mean, that's also the case in Iceland. And that, of course, that's creativity.
Well, it was an Icelander who won this year, actually from my hometown, who won the best picture, I think, both of the major Danish awards.
Yeah.
So we are. But it's also interesting to see what kind of things are encouraged. And, you know, similar, you know, which I never knew with the Finns, because you're always like, oh, you know, they are just so creative and they are so good with design. And then I went to the Finnish Museum of Design, and basically the state decided to really emphasize design education and put a lot of money into design.
Yeah.
So those things also work. Of course. I mean, that's like one of the things that we often see is like those kind of choices about where we are spending money, what kind of education we are encouraging, what kind of creativity we are encouraging has consequences for what kind of individuals are going to be, I don't really want to say produced, but...
Yeah, no, but of course, you know, I mean, it's also naive to think, I mean, it would be also very frustrating thought to think, okay, this is, I mean, it's completely inconsequential. Although there are some, you know, educational theorists who make this argument, so it's completely inconsequential that what you learn in school is just that you, you know, it's just important, just, it's just enough to learn how to learn, and then it basically doesn't matter, you know. And I think there's sort of, there's probably a middle ground, you know, especially if you sort of go on and think about sort of professional learning, you know, I mean, you do want your medical doctor, I mean, you want that this medical doctor also learns something about, you know, how to remove, you know, I mean, appendix, for example.
You know? I think we can agree that's useful.
But on the other hand, you know, I think the medical profession is also fascinating in that, most of the things, I mean, of course, there's the theoretical training, but I mean, you learn how to remove an appendix, you know, on the floor, basically, you know. So there's also, I mean, this is, I mean, you have to practice, you know, your craft.
Well, I think we could continue to talk about this all day, but we've been discussing a wide array of interesting issues. And you mentioned here in the beginning how it was your Icelandic vibe that brought you to Denmark, and you've now been to Iceland many, many times. Probably, I don't know, do you think you've reached 100 times?
Not quite, but I've been here quite a few times. Yes.
Quite a few times. And, you know, we sort of like with our non-Icelandic guests to conclude with their thoughts on Iceland. So, you know.
Well,
has it changed over time? Like, do you feel like Iceland has changed since you were here first?
Definitely, because I mean, I went here for the first time, you know, in the year 2000. And I think that if you look at the numbers, that's basically where the, you know, I mean, like this increase in tourists started, more or less, you know. And by now, I don't know, was it 1.5 million, you know, tourists?
Oh, no. I think we're up to 2.7.
2.7.
I mean,
that is crazy. And you know, and of course, you know, the thing that Iceland has complained about, you know, the puffin shops and everything, that is, I mean, it, you can see it, you know.
So can't you see it everywhere?
Yeah, but
if you have a city where people want to go,
it is quite a change.
Yeah, no, it's a big change.
I would say, you know. Although I don't know, I mean, that, you know, has not affected, you know, me personally in any kind of way. And of course, it's a good thing, I guess, you know. But what I also notice is that, you know, like this, it's such a great thing that you can go to, you know, I mean, to all those natural sites. Mm-hmm. But I also wonder, you know, if that's, I mean, is that sustainable, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you have to start, you know, charging entry fees? Because, I mean, because all these tourists, I mean, they produce, you know, I mean, garbage and all mm-hmm. kinds of things. So I wonder if, you know, if some kind of, I don't know, some measures have to be taken, you know,
mm-hmm.
In order to, I mean, so that this will be sustainable, you know. And what I also noticed is that, like, all the buildings and all in some of the new hotels, when I'm also wondering, okay, is that really, you know, I mean, Harpa is such a great, you know, positive example. I mean, it really does something. But they are like those really, you know, some of those, you know, gigantic hotels that I don't think, I mean, really don't do anything for the city landscape, you know.
Yeah.
And I find it's quite a shame, you know,
yeah.
given that, you know, why people are attracted to Iceland in the first place. You know?
Yeah. Damn capitalism. Well, I think we will say goodbye now. Thank you so much for being with us today,
well, David. Thanks for having me.
And for, you know, being, even though you're mostly stayed in Denmark, you are also part of the Icelandic academic community, and I've been here a visiting guest at the sociology department past weeks.
That would be great in any case. So.
Yeah, so... So thank you so much, and thank you all for listening.
Yeah.